Trusting in the Rock, from Selected Psalms. This is an exposition of Psalm 18, verses 1 through 24. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, June the 21st, 2017.
You know you're getting old when you start hearing your father's voice come out of your own mouth. You find yourself saying those things that just irritated you when you were a child, and you swore you'd never say. Things like, you want to cry? I'll give you something to cry about. Right? Well, when I was a kid, we walked to school. It cost how much? Do you know what a candy bar cost when I was a kid? I used to laugh because I'd hear, yeah, we catch the bus, go downtown, see three movies, have a steak dinner, pay a quarter and get 15 cents back. You know, ridiculous. I first knew I was getting old when I was driving down the street with my kids and I said, this all used to be open out here. And that's when it really hit me. Oh no, I've become my father. Because as a kid, you know, you're driving down the road and he said, and you're going, it's always been this way. As you get older, things change. It's certainly true that as you get older, your perspective changes. You really do view life completely different as you get older. And as you get near the end, and you begin to face your own mortality, then life takes on all new dimensions. Things that you thought were indispensable don't even matter anymore. And things that you thought were insignificant now take center stage. Everything changes. At the end of life, when faced with your own mortality, we all get nostalgic. We look back and remember. And that's really the backdrop of Psalm 18. Psalm 18 is a psalm of David. It's a psalm of thanksgiving, and it follows a psalm of lament in chapter 17. In this psalm, David looks back over his life and gives thanks to the goodness and the grace of God. He gives thanks for the fact that God is good and that God has delivered and shown His grace in glorious ways. If you even just look at the title of Psalm 18, it's kind of long. To the choir master, a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who addressed the words of this song to the Lord on the day when the Lord rescued him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul, he said, long title. Long title, but it gives you the understanding of the context of this particular psalm. It is a psalm of thanksgiving for God's deliverance. It also sets it in historical context. In fact, you can go to 2 Samuel 22 and you'll find this psalm in 2 Samuel 22. So we know that's the context. The context of 2 Samuel chapter 22 puts this at the end of David's life, near to being what could be called David's final words. It's as if David is taking stock of his life, looking back over his life, and he's grateful for the mercy God has shown. He's grateful for God's deliverance throughout his long life of service. That deliverance would include deliverance from the hand of Saul, which he mentions in the title, but also from foreign enemies during his reign, and even from his own son. As David looked back, his heart is overflowing with gratitude. It's a long psalm, so I'm going to just take the first part. We're just going to look down through verse 24 this evening. As we think about it, here's what I want us to see. At the end of the day, the righteous know that they owe everything to the grace of God. The thing that marks the righteous, those who truly trust in the Lord, those who find their strength in the Lord, those who rely upon the Lord, at the end of the day, they say it's all of grace. David, at the end of his days, looks back. He's under no delusion. His wealth, his fame, his fortune are not due to his intelligence or his cunning as a military leader or economic strategy. It is all due to the grace of God. And that's true for all of us. I mean, David was intelligent. David was a cunning military leader, and he made wise economic decisions, but it's the grace of God that sustained the nation. It's the grace of God that upheld them as a people, and that's what David is acknowledging. At the end of the day, when you take a good, hard, honest look back over your life, you ought to be able to say, God has been good. God has been gracious. Because all that we are and all that we have is owed to the grace of God. I don't care how hard you worked. I don't care how sharp you are. Your strength, your intellect, everything you have was given to you by the grace of God. So we owe everything to the grace of God. Three things I want to note from the text. First of all, in the first three verses, the righteous rest in the character and the grace of God. These opening words serve as a prelude. I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. My God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. David expresses his love for God because God has shown himself to David as his deliverer and one who is worthy of his praise. David uses two metaphors to describe God's activity on his behalf. One's military, strength, shield, horn of salvation. The other is that of refuge. He is my rock, my fortress, my deliverer, my stronghold. The prominent note in this particular psalm is God's being David's rock. He refers to God as his rock twice in the second verse. The Lord is my rock, my God is my rock. In verse 31, who is the rock except our God? And again in verse 46, praise be to my rock. Now here's the interesting thing about that. What is David saying? What does the scripture mean when it refers to God as being a rock? That sounds strange to us. How is God a rock? It's a common theme in the Old Testament. But what does it mean? E.M. Blaylock suggests three things in this analogy. First, a rock was a place of protection and shade. So when he speaks of God being his rock, he's saying God is my place of protection. He is my place of shade. In the hot, sandy lands of the Bible, the struggle for life against the merciless elements is intense. In a way, it's hard for us to imagine because we don't live in that climate. We don't live in that context. But when the spring rains came, there'd be a light carpet of green that emerges. But it's doomed. It doesn't last long because the scorching sun and the winds cover it with sand in just a few short weeks. But set a rock in the sand, and a small little oasis begins to develop in the shadow of that rock. The desert's feeble life prospers under the rock's protection. A man traveling through the desert during the hottest hours could find shade in the rock's shadow and survive to continue his journey. And that's the image that David is using in this passage, the image that we find in Isaiah 32 and verse 2. A man will be as a hiding place from the wind and a cover from the tempest, as rivers of water in a dry place, as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. So he describes his God as that place of protection. He gets there and is protected. He is kept from the elements. He is comforted. He is encouraged. He is strengthened by the shade. He is kept sheltered from the scorching heat and wind. God is a place of safety. God is a place of protection. God is a place of rest. That's part of what it means. But further, it means he is a refuge for his people. David is thinking of God's protection during the days of Saul. David knew very well every rock and cranny, every hiding place throughout that wilderness. And so when he fled to the rocks, he knew he was safe in their protection. And David is saying, It's not the physical rocks. It's the presence of my God. He is my place of safety. He is my refuge, the place I run to. The problem with us too often is we go to prayer and we turn to the Lord as a last resort. We've done everything we know to do. And we say, well, I guess I'll trust the Lord. That needs to be our first response. At the first sign of trouble, we flee to our rock, our refuge. There's no shame in that. It's the recognition that we live dependent lives. It's a recognition that everything is beyond my control. Everything is beyond my power. But in my God, there is refuge. There's protection. There is shade. The third thing that Blaylock points to is a rock was a sure foundation. It's the same image that we see in Psalm 40 and verse 2. He is our foundation. As Jesus spoke about building your house upon a rock as upon sand, you build it on sand, and when the winds come and the rains come, it's destroyed, and great is its fall. But when it's founded upon a rock, it will not fall. He is a sure and certain foundation. When we trust in Christ, when we build our life upon rock as upon God as our rock, He is the stabilizing influence. He is our strength and the only one upon whom we can build. So Psalm 18 is this long testimony of the faithfulness of God in each of these aspects. He's a shelter, a stronghold, and a firm foundation for all who will build upon Him. Second, starting in verse 4, then going down through verse 19, the righteous consistently rely on the power and the majesty of God. He sets forth God is His rock. He is His fortress. He is His place of protection. He is His place of safety. He is His oasis. And now he begins to talk about God's power and majesty exercised on His behalf. David recounts what God in grace had done for him. Look at his dilemma in verses 4 and 5. The cords of death encompass me. The torrents of destruction assail me. The cords of Sheol entangle me. The snares of death confront me. This is poetry throughout this whole section. And so parallelism, he's repeating the same idea. This is a man in trouble. This is a man overwhelmed by trial and hardship. And the image you get here in verses 4 and 5, he's drowning. He's drowning in his sorrow. He's drowning in his trouble. Have you noticed sorrows seldom come as single issues? One writer said, sorrows do not come as single soldiers. They always come in battalions. And that seems to be the way it works. Very seldom do you have one thing that goes wrong. Most of us, when something goes wrong, we say, well, now what else? Because we're just confident there's more to follow. And it seems to work that way. First this happens, and then that happens, and then this happens, and everything begins to pile up. That's David's wording in this section. His dilemma is he is desperate. He is overwhelmed. He is incapable of doing anything for himself. And so what does he do? Verse 6, in my distress, I called upon the Lord. To my God, I cried for help. From His temple, He heard my voice, and my cry to Him reached His ears. Again, he didn't cry out to God generic. He didn't cry out to a higher power. He didn't cry out to the God that's out there somewhere as if he doesn't know who he is or anything about him. He uses the word Lord, it's all caps in your English translation, I'm sure, to signify that he is using the covenant name for God. He is crying out to the God who has made specific promises on behalf of his people. So this is not a desperate man just crying out for some kind of relief. It is a man who is desperate, who is calling out to a specific God to deliver because he knows this God, he knows the promise of this God, and he is certain that this God will deliver him. The righteous consistently rely on the power and the majesty of God. Then verse 7 down through verse 19 is the description of God's deliverance. Images from Mount Sinai and from Egypt. Because David is saying the God of Moses is also the God of David. He's saying that the God of the covenant is the God of David. He is reminding himself and all who hear this song of the great things that God has done. And because God has done it for his people in the past, his present people can trust on the same God to deliver them in their present trial. The earth reeled and rocked. Foundations also of the mountain trembled and quaked because he was angry. Smoke went up from his nostrils and devouring fire from his mouth. Glowing coals flamed forth from him. He bowed the heavens and came down. Thick darkness was under his feet. He rode on the cherub and flew. He came swiftly on the wings of the wind. He made darkness his covering, his canopy around him, thick clouds, dark with water. All this imagery from Sinai. You remember when God showed up and the fire was on the mountain? You remember in chapter 20 as he gave the Ten Commandments? You remember before Moses came down with the written copies etched in stone, God spoke them. And when he spoke, the mountain shook. It's all this image of the fiery, brilliant, awesome, comforting, terrifying presence of God, his majesty and his glory. Verse 12 and down through verse 14 speak of his conquering of Canaan. Out of the brightness before him, hailstones and coals of fire broke through his clouds. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice, hailstones and coals of fire. And he sent out his arrows and scattered them, flashed forth lightnings and routed them. Then the channels of the sea were seen, the foundations of the world were laid bare at your rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. So the conquest of Canaan, the parting of the Red Sea and the parting of the Jordan, all of that included is he's rehearsing for the people what God has done in the past. And then verses 16 through 19, God's specific deliverance. He sent from on high, he took me. He drew me out of many waters. He rescued me from my strong enemy and from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the days of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. God delivered. And in delivering, God brought him out to a broad place. Why that reference to a broad place? What was their background? They were slaves. They were restricted. They were limited. They had little to no freedom. This imagery of being brought out into a broad place is the image of great freedom. Deliverance to a wide space, wide open. All of this is yours. It speaks to the abundance of God's provision and the glory of his provision. And don't miss the last part of verse 19. He did all this because he delighted in me. David's not being arrogant. David is not claiming some special favor on his behalf. What he's saying is, this was all undeserved. This was due to God's gracious choice. This was all due to God's favor. It's grace. He did this because he delighted in me. He didn't say, he did all this because I'm delightful. That's an important distinction. He didn't say he did this because of me. He said he did because he delighted to do so. It began in the heart of God. God is gracious. God is merciful. Therefore, the righteous consistently rely on the power and the majesty of God. As his child, you have every reason to believe that God delights in you. Just think about that for a minute. Think about that the next time that you have had a horrible day. Think about that the next time somebody said something ugly, hurtful. The next time you get a phone call from the doctor and it's not a good report, questions are raised, give thought to the fact that your God delights in you. He cares about you. You are precious to Him. And then realize it's not because of anything in you. It's because of the heart of your God. And why does that matter? That matters because you don't have to perform in order for Him to love you. You don't have to meet His expectation in order for Him to show you His favor. It is His loving, gracious choice. He loves us. He loves His people. Because He delights in me, He delivered me. A third thing, the righteous trust in the faithfulness of God. Verse 20 down through verse 24. The Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, He rewarded me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all His rules were before me, and His statutes I did not put away from me. I was blameless before Him, and I kept myself from my guilt. So the Lord has rewarded according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in His sight. Now, question. How in the world can David say that if he's at the end of his life? Because if he's at the end of his life, that's post Bathsheba, when he sinned greatly, when he committed adultery, when he murdered a man to cover up his sin. How can David say, I'm blameless? Well, we start by recognizing he's not claiming sinless perfection. If you look at the rest of Psalm 18, you consider Psalm 51, David repeatedly talks of his sin and his unfaithfulness and God's rightful judgment. All David is saying is, as a principle, God honors righteousness. Same thing Paul says in 2 Timothy 2:13. If we are faithless, He remains faithful, for He cannot deny Himself. Now, it's also important to recognize the last part of verse 24. So the Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands, catch the last line, in His sight. David said, clean, blameless, in the sight of God because of God's cleansing, because of God's grace, because of God's mercy. Here's the glorious thing about the forgiveness and grace, the mercy of our God. When we are forgiven, we are genuinely forgiven. The record is erased. The debt is paid. That's why the biblical writer says He separates our sin as far as the east is from the west. It's infinite. He buries our sin in the depths of the sea. Corrie Ten Boom added, and He hangs a sign that says no fishing. It's not to be brought up again. So again, David's not saying, I never sinned. He's saying, in the sight of God, I'm clean and blameless because of His mercy, because of His cleansing, because of His forgiveness. The righteous know they owe everything to the grace of God. Thus they rest in the character of God's grace. They consistently rely on the power and the majesty of God, and they trust in His faithfulness. He is forever faithful, and therein is our hope.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.